number of years ago, I was doing a workshop with some young adults. And a part of that workshop was to collect images of God from the Scripture. Now, before we actually opened the Bible, however, I asked them how many they could name without looking it up. This was a closed book test. How many images of God can you name without looking? We named over 70. God is described as rock. God is described as fortress. God is described as wind. God is described as a mother bird. God is described as a father. God is described in numerous ways. Now, of course, for us as Christians, the ultimate description of God is the description we find in the Gospels, in the person of Jesus. But the image of God we carry in our head, the image of God we tend to put forefront in our minds and lives, determines how we treat other people. If the primary biblical images of God that we carry are of a God who will destroy a whole group of people so another people can have their land, then that must be okay, right? It's in there. We have to deal with it. But it's not consistent with Jesus or the way Jesus dealt with others. The image of God that we have forefront in our lives not only affects how we treat family and friends, but especially it affects how we treat the other, the stranger, and particularly those we describe or our culture describes for us as enemy. A question that arises from the text is God trustworthy? Can we trust that God has our best interest at heart, but not just ours alone, the best interest of all creation at heart? And the image of God we carry with us really affects how we understand that trust in God. I mean, think about Jesus. In the garden, praying, let this bitter cup pass from me, but if it be your will, then your will, not mine. Can you imagine how much trust that takes when the soldiers come to get you, when you stand in front of Pilate, when they literally torture you to death, and while you're hanging there, pulling up to breathe and letting down when it becomes too painful, how much trust it takes to say, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. That image of God that we see enacted in the very person of Jesus shapes who we are as a congregation. Now, I mentioned earlier, this is the 75th anniversary of worship here in this sanctuary. The education building was finished in 1929, the week of the stock market crash, and the congregation worshiped across the street in Neely Chapel, it was called then, at Vanderbilt. And then in 1940, after much struggle and much sacrifice, worshiped here. I happened, with a lot of help from our archives and history folks, to have a copy of that service of consecration that was held on March 10th, 1940. I want to read you part of the words of consecration. We consecrate this church to the help of the oppressed. See, if you thought the word oppressed was a modern thing, it's not. To the comfort of the sorrowful, to the consolation of the dying, to the edification of the faithful, and to the persuasion of those who have not yet believed, to the sanctifying of the life that now is, and to the proclamation the reality of life eternal. We consecrate this church to plead the cause of righteousness and justice and brotherhood. Today we would add sisterhood. To lift up her voice against all human wrong and to make straight in the desert a highway for our God. That's our job description. Of course, the overall description is love God and love your neighbor as yourself, but this gets down to the specifics. Opposing oppression, working for justice, welcoming those who need faith but do not have it yet so they can learn to trust the God that we already trust. This is all based upon an image of God that says God opposes oppression. God works for justice. God welcomes those who have not yet learned to trust in God. And this is to be a place where they can learn that very thing. When you hear the text from Hebrews, that the word of the Lord is like a two-edged sword, depending on your image of God, that could be a very frightening thing. Or, interestingly enough, it could be a very helpful and comforting thing. If you think that God is an angry and punishing God, then you better watch out for that two-edged sword. It's going to hack you to pieces. But that's not what happens here. It divides soul and spirit. It cuts away, true. But what's left is the human being laid bare, naked, the way God created us, in the sight of God who knows us already. Cutting away those things that stand between us and God. Those things that our culture puts on us, those things we've chosen to put on ourselves, those things our parents or our teachers or our society has told us we ought to be, cuts all that away. And it can do that and lay us bare, and we can trust that that is not done by a God who wants to punish or hurt us, but a God who loves us and act mercifully toward us. Because we have a great high priest, the selfie of God, Jesus, who knows everything that we could possibly go through because he's been through it. Was tested in every way that we could possibly be tested, but without sin. Doesn't mean he never made a mistake. Okay? Remember the story when he's lost from his family and he's still a kid and his mother finds him and she gets on to him? No. What it means is he never lost trust that God had his best interest and even the best interest of those who crucified him at heart. We don't have to be worried when we are laid bare in front of God, because you see, God knows us already and loves us more than we could possibly ever imagine. Last year, Margaret and I got to take the trip of a lifetime. We had saved up for it for a long time and looked forward to it for a long time. And last November, we got to go to Italy, very first time to the continent. And we didn't range very widely. We ranged really between Rome and Florence. And in Florence, we went to a lot of the different sites and the different museums. We went to the Academy to see the statue of David, Michelangelo's David. It's a magnificent piece. Many of you have seen it, probably. But to think that a sculptor could take a piece of stone and discover in that stone what seems to be an almost perfect physical body. And I say discover very carefully. I choose that word carefully because you see, Michelangelo believed that we participated with God in the creative act, but that we didn't create anything. We simply discovered what God had put there already. So when he saw a piece of stone, he worked on it, releasing that image that was already present there. I can't even begin to imagine how someone could do that and come up with David. But equally impressive to me were the four pieces that line the walls as you approached David. Traditionally, they're called the prisoners. They're unfinished pieces. You see a little bit of an image of a person emerging from a block of stone. Some are more finished than others. The bearded prisoner is the most complete of all. I don't think I need to comment on that, do I? You see also how Michelangelo worked. He worked from the front of the body to the back because those parts that are completed are all the front of the body. And it's interesting because as you walk through, there's almost a sense of motion and struggle for those bodies pulling out of that stone, pulling out from all of those things that would hold them from being fully realized. All those things that for us are those expectations that have been laid on us by our profession, by our teachers, by our parents, by our society, who we think we're supposed to be. I'm going to suggest to you that that double-edged sword might also be described as a mallet and chisel. And God spends a lifetime trying to chisel away all those expectations the culture puts on us, so that we can get to that person that God created us to be from the very beginning, from the very start. And all of our experiences, even the most difficult and tragic, are part of that chipping away of what Thomas Merton called the false self, what T.S. Eliot called the face to meet the faces that we meet, the persona, the outward appearance that we create, instead of the true person that God created. And perhaps our whole life is that struggle to allow God to chip away all that doesn't belong so that we can emerge as that creation God intended us to be. Yesterday, I got to see a dear friend who attended this church for several years when she lived in Nashville, then moved to St. Louis. In fact, she's here this morning. I haven't asked her permission to quote her, but I'm going to do it anyway. Eliza Lynn was playing as part of a presentation by Fiona Ritchie about music that came from the British Isles, from Scotland, Ireland, and such over to this country. And as Eliza and I were catching up a little bit, she had been a part of our community here. She had gone to St. Louis to go to theological school. And said something that just really struck me, I guess because this sermon was rolling around in my head. She said, "I discovered I already have a ministry. I'm an artist." I thought, yeah. It's that person who is emerging from the stone. It's that person God created us to be in the first place. And we don't need a bishop to put hands on our head for that to be a ministry. And we don't need a board of ordained ministry to approve us somehow for that to be a ministry. We don't even need a church to say, "Oh yeah, we see that as your ministry." We can claim it for our own because God created us that way. It is our true self. And when we are operating out of the true self, we recognize that. And the rest of life is just a chipping away of all that would keep us prisoner, of all that would hold us back. And some of us are just beginning to emerge from the stone, and some of us are almost all out of the stone, and of course, Jesus is the one who is all the way out. The one at the end of the hall, the descendant of David, whom we look to because he has been through all of that emergence and has had all that chipped away, and never lost trust that God had his best interest and even the best interest of those who crucified him at heart. My friends, that's our calling. We are called, insofar as we can, to allow that chipping away process to happen so that we too can emerge, the true self can emerge, that God has called and will use. I don't know how. I don't know how God's going to use you. But you have a particular set of gifts, and God will use them. I can promise you that. We do not worship a God who is malevolent, who wants to hurt us, who wants to punish us. We worship a God who loves us and cares for us enough to chip away everything that would hold us prisoner so that we can emerge into the true self that God has seen all along and that God intends us to be. Thanks be to God.